ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, no relief on mortgage payments. The Reserve Bank keeps interest rates on hold and declares the war on inflation is far from over. Also, the incredible shrinking Olympics. Could the Brisbane Games in 2032 set a new trend with the use of smaller venues? And in the Victorian town of Pomona, residents are rebuilding 5 weeks after devastating bushfires.
Our community will survive and will grow, and we will lose people, but I think we can see a future. It's happening. Things are happening again.
First tonight, as was widely tipped, the Reserve Bank has decided to leave interest rates unchanged at 4.35%. It may come as a relief to borrowers. Many economists think the bank will start cutting rates later in the year, but at this stage it's still too hard to say exactly when. Our reporter David Taylor was at the Reserve Bank Governor's press conference. David, interest rates were widely expected to remain on hold today, but was there any new information that came out today that surprised you?
Well, Samantha, the Reserve Bank is making a big effort to be clear and transparent in its communications, which sees a two-day meeting followed by an interest rates decision at 2:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time, followed by pretty much a one-hour length press conference. And within that, a lot of the same stuff, the issues that have been cropping up over the past 12 months were there at the forefront. But critically, after 13 interest rate increases since the Reserve Bank started raising rates, and now that the economic outlook would normally appear to be coming well into view, the Reserve Bank is still saying that the outlook is uncertain. Now, that tells you pretty clearly that the Reserve Bank does not know where it's going to go next in terms of easing policy or tightening policy further or remaining on hold, which is quite unusual at this stage of the cycle. In addition to that, Samantha, we've got wages growth, according to the Reserve Bank, appears to have peaked. Now, wages growth for the past decade has been stagnant to nothing at all in terms of growth. And it has picked up recently. There's been some noticeable Fair Work cases. What the Reserve Bank is saying now is that if there is to be any hope of the inflation rate returning to what it would like it to be of between 2% and 3%, then wages growth has to basically have peaked where it is at the moment, somewhere between 3% and 4%. Now, in addition to that, the Reserve Bank is also hoping that productivity, or the way we work, the smarter way we work, or the more effective way we work, is going to return to long-run averages. And it has been dismal in recent years. So, I mean, they're two additional bits of information, but also, and I don't know whether you'd call this new information, but Sam, there is the possibility, of course, that interest rates are yet to go up again.
So what, David, do you think is top of mind now for the Reserve Bank?
Well, the unemployment rate is being watched extremely closely. It's moved up above 4%, and Michelle Bullock, before she was governor, said that it was possible that the unemployment rate needed to rise to about 4.5% in order for the Reserve Bank's inflation goals to be satisfied. So the unemployment rate is going to be key in terms of whether there's too much pressure on being put on the economy with higher interest rates. But the other thing, of course, is that inflation remains top of mind. It's come down a long way since it peaked at around about 8%, but the last mile of inflation to get it down to about 2 to 3%, it's currently about 4.1%, is going to be really tricky. So I asked the Reserve Bank Governor, Michelle Bullock, if she was worried about the economy.
I'm worried about inflation. I am watching very closely what's happening with growth in the economy. If our forecasts come true, and I really hope we're on that narrow path that Phil used to talk about, then we can slow the economy enough that it preserves a lot of the gains in employment and brings inflation down. If we can pull that off, then I think that will be great.
RBA Governor Michelle Bullock there. So clearly the juggle, if you like, Sam, is making sure that the economy slows sufficiently to get inflation down, but not so much that the unemployment rate starts to really ratchet up. And of course, that would obviously lead to a recession. So the Reserve Bank's in a very tricky spot.
David Taylor reporting. Well, if you've been stunned by the size of your electricity bills recently, there may be some good news for you today. After 2 years of hefty increases, it looks like the price of power for consumers in the eastern states is set to drop. The Australian Energy Regulator has today released its draft decision on the nation's main consumer price caps, which are known as default market offers. And it's recommended the maximum retailers can charge drop by between 1 and 10%, depending on where you live and whether your bill is for a small business or a private residence. John Daly has more.
After a long run of soaring electricity prices, news that there'll be a slight reduction in some states has come as a relief. Tom Cox runs a milk bar in Newcastle, 120 kilometres north of Sydney. In his area, small businesses can expect a power bill reduction of nearly 10%.
Let's say 10%, you know, would be, you know, the equivalent of like $1,100, $1,200. You know, that's an extra $1,200 that can be used, you know, for other things, you know, repairs or making the business grow rather than trying to stay afloat.
The Australian Energy Regulator will marginally reduce its benchmark retail energy prices as coal and gas prices fall and renewables continue their rise. While he's happy to see the price come down, Tom Cox says it's still pretty meagre considering power prices shot up 40% post-COVID.
You know, it helps, but, you know, it's not, you know, along with the other factors that come running a business, you know, all the price increases that we've had running a cafe profitably has definitely become exponentially harder than it used to.
The default market offer, or DMO, is set by regulators as a guide for private power companies and consumers to set and compare prices. Bills should fall between 1.9% and 3% for residential customers in Sydney and South Australia, reducing bills by up to $57 a year. Meanwhile, Victoria's Essential Services Commission has proposed reducing that state's default offer by 6.4%. But in some places, prices might be going up. Bills will increase by up to 2.7% in households in southeast Queensland and 0.9% for those in rural New South Wales, adding up to $53 a year to bills. Australian Energy Regulator Chair Claire Savage says the benchmark differs from place to place.
So, for example, in New South Wales, if you're a residential customer, you could expect decreases between minus 7% all the way up to a very small increase of plus 0.9%. It does depend on, because there are three different areas in New South Wales, whether you live in sort of Sydney City, Western Sydney or rural New South Wales, they have different prices in different parts of that state.
The reductions are quite modest, especially given wholesale electricity prices have roughly halved in the last year from the extreme highs in 2022. Global coal and gas prices have fallen as the world ramps up the adoption of renewables, but Claire Savage says those reductions in the cost of generation have been offset by the high costs of transmission.
But we have got lower wholesale costs. Offsetting that, though, has been some increases in network prices. So they're the poles and wires costs, the cost of transporting electricity.
The cost of poles and wires are a big part of retail power bills, making up about 40% of the price. To a degree, the shift to renewables has increased transmission costs. The bigger factor is rising interest rates. That's because customers have to pay a fee to the private companies that own billions of dollars worth of power infrastructure across the country. And that fee takes into account the cost of capital. Tim Buckley is director of the think tank Climate Energy Finance.
Inflation's doubled, interest rates have doubled. As a result, that feeds directly into the cost of capital equation, and regulated assets are given a regulator return based on their current and forecast cost of capital. So unfortunately, that's a 20, 30, 40% increase in the regulated rate of return these asset owners, monopoly owners, are going to be receiving from us, the consumer.
Tim Buckley sees two ways the transmission costs could be reduced. Firstly, inflation and interest rates need to be brought under control, and that's not so simple. The other way is more focus on the grid's efficiency and better utilising batteries and rooftop solar, so we don't need to keep building new poles and wires.
I would actually emphasise the value of the federal government working with the states to roll out distributed energy resources. Australia's got the highest penetration per capita in the world of rooftop solar. This is a real wake-up call to remind us, let's accelerate that. Let's leverage the existing grid assets.
The opposition says the government has failed on its election promise of a $275 reduction in power bills by 2025. Energy and Climate Change Minister Chris Bowen says there's more work to do.
I'll have more to say in coming weeks about our rollout of renewables in the capacity investment scheme. There's been a huge amount of work going to that. We have a lot more work to do. This is an encouraging signpost, if you like, but it is far from a finishing post.
The Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen. That report from John Daly. 5 weeks after bushfires devastated Pomonal in Victoria's west, the effort to rebuild lost homes is getting underway. 46 houses were destroyed by the blazes. That's a lot anywhere, but particularly in a town with a population of only 300. Some residents have had to move far away while their homes are reconstructed. But as Oliver Gordon reports, a local group is doing all it can to house those who lost everything.
Anton Henriksen is one of many Pomonal residents to have lost pretty much everything in last month's fires.
There's absolutely nothing. There's not even any floorboards in the house, so everything that was burnt fell through into the ashes.
It's a tough time for his family.
My wife doesn't really want to come back. She said everything she loved about this place is gone.
Russ Kellett, a volunteer with the Country Fire Authority in the bush town, was one of the first firefighters to tackle the blaze. While 46 homes were lost, the emergency crews protected more than 80 homes, as well as the church, the main store and the school.
We knew if we could keep those places alive, it'd help with the spirit of the place.
The local men's shed has become a focal point for recovery efforts and the recipient of donations from across the state.
People who've lost all their sheds and stuff and still have a house have been able to start getting tools and doing stuff and feeling like they're doing stuff.
But for those residents who lost homes, staying close to Pomonal has been a challenge. To address the problem, the town's resilience group, which resident Alison Bainbridge is a part of, has swung into action.
Housing is an issue up here, as it is with a lot of small places. At the resilience group, we got people to just work on housing. We broke up into different groups, and that housing group was able to locate and touch base with, you know, real estate agents and other people to get accommodation for people, not just for a couple of weeks or a few days, but for 6 to 12 months. And that's what people really needed if they wanted to stay in the area, and we were trying to keep our community together as much as possible.
The resilience group kept an inventory of those who needed help and those who were offering.
And then it was up to the individuals to work out whether that was a suitable accommodation. So it was putting those together, which is really joining the dots, which is what resilience was doing.
Alison Bainbridge has been happy with the level of support on offer for those struggling.
Grampians Community Health is here and here for the long haul as far as mental health, assisting us with that. And they've been here, and the council has been here. They've been out staying with us at the general store or at the hall. It's like they haven't disappeared after 2 weeks. They're still here.
And it is needed. Many residents, like John Matthews, still occasionally becoming overwhelmed by the devastation.
Yesterday I had my first cry, so I'll admit that. I'm sure there's been others that have cried more often or not, or if they haven't, they might need to.
And while some residents are reporting positive experiences with insurance companies, others like Colin McCaffer aren't sure their insurance money will cover the cost of rebuilding.
With all the environmental things that you've got to do to your house now to get permits to build, the increase of that replacement cost can go up significantly, which means you could be underinsured.
There's no doubt about the struggles facing many in Pomonal, but Alison Bainbridge from the town's resilience group is confident its residents can rise to the occasion.
I was thinking about this the other day when I was at the recovery, which has been at our little church, and it's going to move to the hall soon. I looked across and there was already the new regrowth on the burnt tree. So it gave me a lot of hope. The amount of support and people helping each other, our community will survive and will grow, and we will lose people, but still emotional. But I think
We can see a future. It's happening. Things are happening again. I've got a lot of hope for our little community because we're a very connected community.
Alison Bainbridge, a resident of Pomonal in Victoria's West. That report from Oliver Gordon, Gillian Area and Angus McIntosh. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, volunteers step in to help a colony of penguins near Perth survive the summer heatwave.
And this is a great opportunity for us humans to do the right thing. So if we can't do something for penguins, then, you know, we need to really look at ourselves. And if you do things like this, then we as humans will benefit from it.
The ABC is backing a decision to air a documentary about the Russian side of the Ukraine war last night, despite claims the public broadcaster has streamed propaganda in prime time. The decision to air the 45-minute show called Ukraine's War, The Other Side, has sparked an angry response, with Ukraine's ambassador to Australia describing it as the journalistic equivalent of a bowl of vomit. The ABC says the documentary was challenging but legitimate. But Russia experts are questioning whether the aggressor in the Ukraine conflict should be given such a high-profile platform. Stephanie Smail reports.
As the deadly war in Ukraine drags on, documentary maker Sean Langan went behind Russian lines to hear their side of the story.
I was warned not to go in with the Russians. And some people ask, should we even be telling their side of the story?
The 45-minute documentary is wide-ranging, capturing interviews with soldiers across the war zone.
We're not monsters, we're humans, and we defend our people.
Here, Sean Langan is asking soldiers camping in a forest how they feel that the West doesn't support them.
Is there a little bit of hurt that the West doesn't understand their side?
The Ukrainian ambassador to Australia, Vasyl Marushnichenko, has lashed out at the ABC for airing the program. He argues the only person benefiting from this kind of storytelling is the Russian president, Vladimir Putin.
Who's, you know, had like a full 45 minutes of delivering blatant lies, which come from all those Russian soldiers. And, you know, mind you, those were the same people that have been killing Ukrainian innocent women and men. And I mean, and they are out there providing their view on the situation and describing this whole war as if they are protecting themselves. They are invading a foreign country in blatant violation of all international law and killing people out there. But they still, you know, nobody's really challenging them on their assertion that this is, you know, their war that they are fighting for.
Mr. Miroshnichenko says he wants to meet with ABC management to ask why the documentary was aired. He says the rest of the ABC's coverage of the Ukraine war has been fair.
So I was very surprised to see a public broadcast in Australia, you know, basically screening Russian propaganda in prime time.
Would you still describe it as a bowl of vomit?
It is, because this is how I felt. You know, this is how I felt, you know, watching it for 45 minutes.
The ABC says it will be meeting with the Ukrainian ambassador, but the broadcaster is standing by its decision to run the program. In a statement, an ABC spokesperson says the documentary adds to our understanding of the tragic conflict and shows the full horrific impact of the war. They say journalist Sean Langan challenges the Russian soldiers and civilians featured in the film about their beliefs. In one part of the program, the journalist asks a soldier about when the war will end.
You said something there which I find a little disturbing. If Kiev is friendly to you, then you will give them freedom.
We want to return to us this land.
The documentary has already aired in the United Kingdom to a mixed response.
It's amplifying what Russia would like us to see and what Russia would like us to be talking about.
Russia expert Matthew Sussex says after watching the program, he was compelled to criticise it on social media, which he says is unusual for him.
But I said it was an abysmal decision to platform it. And that we don't platform Iranian propaganda, and we don't platform Chinese propaganda. So why we decided to do this, or the ABC decided to do this on this occasion, is kind of beyond me.
The visiting fellow at the Australian National University's Strategic Independent Studies Centre argues the ABC has made the wrong decision.
Balance doesn't mean every possible interpretation should get airtime. And balance doesn't necessarily mean absolute total neutrality. It is obviously the case that there is one side that's been wronged in this conflict and one side has caused that wrong, and we need to acknowledge that.
In a statement, the ABC describes the documentary as a challenging but legitimate piece of work. The spokesperson says Australian audiences have a right to watch it and make up their own minds.
Stephanie Smale reporting. Well, are we about to see a shift to smaller, less extravagant Olympic Games? The Queensland government has opted to use existing facilities for the 2032 event instead of building a new $3.4 billion stadium. Experts say this could be the start of a more sustainable event, opening up hosting opportunities to more nations. This report from Elizabeth Cramsey.
The Brisbane 2032 Olympics might look a little different to what some were expecting. Having rejected calls for a brand new stadium in inner city Victoria Park, the state government's opted to use rugby league venue Lang Park instead. Richard Barker is from the Olympic and Paralympic Research Centre at Victoria University. He says this is the start of a new approach to the Games,
which is to not make host cities have expensive facilities that might be white elephants in the end, even though there are attempts to make them very usable and legacy-oriented afterwards. So in their policy document, which is called Olympic Agenda 2020 Plus 5, they actually have a statement that says, under sustainable Olympic Games, no new venues are needed, and the use of temporary or facilities or upgraded facilities is encouraged. So it falls in line with that thinking, because the IOC wants more bid cities, because cities aren't bidding because of the expense of some of the infrastructure, especially the main stadium.
It means Brisbane won't have a huge stadium like those used in previous Olympics, and it will instead refurbish older stadiums. Mr. Barker says older venues have been used successfully in the past.
It's interesting. Did you know the LA Olympics that were held in 1932 used the Coliseum? They used that same stadium again in 1984, and they're going to use it again in 2028. So that's quite fascinating. They'll update it, obviously. But we haven't seen it sort of pushed at this point, where the IOC is encouraging the use of facilities that are temporary or upgraded as much as they are now. They just think it's a waste of money, and it's puts a negative stain on the Olympics, because the public gets a backlash, and they usually use the term, we want bread, not circuses.
The athletics events are set to be held at CUSAC, despite the independent review recommending it not be used. Mr. Barker doesn't see a problem with that decision.
They'll still be pretty good. I think it says going to have up to about 40,000, except for finals and certain events. You don't usually get a full house and all the preliminary stuff. So it's just a new style of Olympics, where they're not demanding billions and billions of dollars spent. There's white elephants at the end. There's no legacy issues.
Jane Fleming is a two-time Olympian and the president of Athletics Australia.
We were really after having some legacy venues for athletics for a change. And so this has really played into Athletics Australia's wishes. This is going to be something that we'll be able to use before the Games, in the lead up to the Games, and after the Games.
She says whiz-bang new facilities don't necessarily create a legacy.
In, you know, the history of most Olympic Games, and in fact the history of most of the multi-sport events that we've hosted in Australia, there are these big, huge, very expensive stadiums built. They lay a track, and then as soon as the Games are finished, they rip up the athletics track and use it for other professional sports. So we were very much in keeping with what the Premier of Queensland has suggested in refurbishing the old QE2, or CUSAC as it's known now, and it was obviously purpose-built for the 1982 Commonwealth Games and hasn't had much money spent on it since. But it is a perfect venue to host the athletics.
So will the decision impact the number of international visitors coming to Brisbane for the Games and the number of tourism dollars they bring in? Jane Fleming doesn't think so.
I don't perceive that as being an issue at all as far as the Olympics are concerned. And if you think about the whole concept of refurbishing existing facilities, things like the CUSAC budget, $600 million. Well, the stadium is hardly going to look like a dog's breakfast for that kind of money. So we're still going to have some really fantastic facilities, and they will be world class, and that's what the IOC would expect as well.
But of course, these plans aren't set in concrete. With the state election due in only 7 months, the topic of Olympic venues could once more be on the table.
Elizabeth Cramsey reporting. Western Australia has just experienced its hottest summer on record, and humans aren't the only ones who've been struggling with the scorching temperatures. The heat waves are threatening the survival of a colony of penguins south of Perth. So local volunteers have been building modern nesting boxes to help them get through the tough conditions and ensure Penguin Island keeps living up to its name. This report from Ruby Littler.
It's a nervous housewarming for these two little penguins, but their nest on an island near Perth is a little different. The architects are humans, and one of them is conservationist turned volunteer Rick Dawson.
As we know, whether we like it or not, our climate is warm, so every opportunity to make it a cooler environment for the penguins so they can nest successfully is what we're about.
These animals are the smallest penguin species in the world. Just over a decade ago, WA's Penguin Island was home to a colony of about 1,300 little penguins. But experts say it's now estimated there are just 300 left. And a big cause of their decline has been rising temperatures. So Rick Dawson and his Rotary Club are determined to increase their chances of survival by protecting them against the heat.
And this is a great opportunity for us humans to do the right thing. So if we can't do something for penguins, then, you know, we need to really look at ourselves. And if you do things like this, then we as humans will benefit from it.
Nesting boxes have been on the island for decades, but they're falling apart, and it's actually created a hotter environment for the penguins. So a team of volunteers and scientists have been working to design, build and install a much cooler place to nest. Conservation biologist Dr. Erin Clithrow is with WA's Department of Conservation.
This is our third or fourth model, or fifth, I've lost count now. And, you know, each model we're trying to reduce that temperature just a little bit more. And these, the most recent boxes, the ones that we're putting in today, they use a double-walled construction, so using air as insulation, and we're been able to reduce the temperature by 8 degrees inside those boxes. So that's 8 degrees cooler in the nest boxes than it is in the surrounding environment and those natural nests and vegetation.
She says the boxes play an important role in helping the population adapt to climate change. University of Western Australia's Dr. Belinda Cannell agrees. She isn't involved in the project, but she's been studying the little penguins for 3 decades.
We get a lot of birds dying from overheating in the summertime during the molt period, but when temperatures reach above 35 degrees or around 33 degrees is when penguins become heat stressed. And if it's 35 degrees or above and it's like that for a consistent period of time, then they will die of overheating. So in our summers, unfortunately, like we've just had, where we've had these a large number of days with really high above average temperatures, then we will find that we will get birds dying from overheating. Summertime is particularly problematic for little penguins because that's when they molt. And when they molt, they're stuck on the island for 2 weeks.
She fears the population near Perth could become extinct within our generation.
The more that we get community involved, the more that they're aware that the penguins are out there, and then hopefully for a number of reasons we can actually get that support to help reduce all the impacts that we can't control that are on the penguins.
And back at the workshop, volunteer Rick Dawson warns there's no time to lose.
You know, I would hate to think that my grandchildren weren't here to see penguins. I mean, how lucky are we on our doorstep? I mean, you've got the jewel of the crown here in Rockingham. You've got Shoalwater Islands Marine Park. It's got seals, it's got penguins, it's got dolphins, it's got a fantastic seabird life, you know. So let's start somewhere and start working on our penguins and keep them here in their environment, and let's all enjoy the opportunity to see them.
Experts believe this approach and the research conducted on Penguin Island could help other penguin colonies adapt to a warming climate.
Ruby Littler reporting there from Perth. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. That's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley. Each weekday morning, the podcast takes an in-depth look at one particular issue in the news. Tomorrow, it's the push to ban TikTok in the United States, and whether China's links to the social media app make it a serious security threat. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you can join us then. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Last week, hundreds of US politicians got behind a bill that would ban TikTok, unless its Chinese parent company sells it. They're worried the app could be used by the Chinese Communist Party to steal data and influence Americans. So, if it's axed in the US, will Australia do the same? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.